truth and to be able to teach the Word of God. As I said this morning, the reason we're all here is because of Jesus Christ. It is His death, His burial, His resurrection, and with humility that we would present His Word to you. Today I'd like for us to look at a prophet that is called Habakkuk. One of the things I've always appreciated about... I hope I got this thing on. He's just wanting to warm it up, maybe. Is the fact that these prophets are really... There we go. We're in. Is the fact that the prophets really teach a lot of things that are very appropriate even for us today. As we begin to look at the New Testament, many times the Old Testament is being quoted. But the issue that we look at is the fact that if we haven't gone back and read what the quotation is from, we miss some of the great beauty that maybe Paul or Peter or some of the Hebrew writers have made about some of these prophets. The book of Habakkuk, the word Habakkuk or the name means to clasp or embrace. I would suggest when you start reading names of the Old Testament or any place that you understand that there are times that these names really have some tremendous meaning. One of the greatest illustrations I can think of is, you remember the story of Rachel and Leah, and Rachel was a very pretty woman and Leah was not so pretty. She had something wrong with her eyes, weak eyes or whatever. He was married to both of them through trickery. Jacob was married to them by Laban, who tricked him into marrying both, at least marrying Leah. And she was not the loved or favorite one. But when she started having children, she started naming those children. And if you missed those names, you would have missed the heartbreak that Leah had in that relationship. The first one was named Reuben, and Reuben means, behold a son. In other words, Jacob, do you see this child I have here? I have a son for you. Rachel may be the pretty girl, maybe the babe or whatever, how you look at her. She may be the pretty one, but I've given you a son. Behold a son. Then she has another child, and she, Reuben, then she names him Simeon, which means to hear. Are you listening, Jacob? This is son number two. The score is 2-0. The third little child that she has is named Levi. And the word Levi means attached. Means, you should be attached to me. This is the third son that I've had to Rachel's none. And then the fourth child she has is, she names him Judah, which means praise. And she praises God that she has this son. Did you feel the heartbreak in that? I hope you did, because that's exactly what you do when you start reading the names of the Bible. Never let names go be away from you. It's just like, well, his name is Habakkuk, just like my name is Dennis. My mom had no idea what the name Dennis meant. Came from Dionysius, which means the prince or the god of wine. I'm not sure if she thought maybe I'd be a wino or a great vineyard guy that would produce wine. I don't think she thought of any of those things. But when it comes right down to it, when you start looking at names in the Bible, they do have meaning. Jacob meant surplanter, the guy that pulls a rug out from somebody else. And of course, he pulled the rug out on his brother. And then the name Israel. Israel means the idea of a prince or a ruler with God or contender with God. And El is God. So names like that mean something. Beth means house. Bethel means the house of God. Bethlehem, Lehem means bread. So the house, Jesus came from the house of bread. I just bring this real quickly to you, but I think it's important when we look at names like Habakkuk, need to embrace or clasp. What he's saying here is that he is embracing his people to God. So we begin. The book was written about a little before or a little after 605 B.C. The internal community was shocked by the events that had far-reaching importance to them. The internal problems of religion and morality in Judah were also a cause for concern for the prophet Habakkuk, as Habakkuk embraced his people as he approached God. Looking at the external events, when the Assyrian capital of Nineveh was overrun by the Babylonians in 612 BC, the Assyrians moved their capital to Haran. When Haran was captured by the Babylonians in 610 BC, the capital again was moved to, this time to Carchemish on the Euphrates River. Egypt was allied with Assyrian king Ashur-Nabalat II and marched in 609 BC to his aid against the Babylonians. So let's start with this. First of all, you are no longer living in this town of Eugene, Oregon. Let's put you down somewhere here, maybe in Jerusalem, at this stage of the game.
And over here in this Fertile Crescent, now nobody marched through this area here because that was a great big desert. But the Babylonians started out in Babylon and they defeated the Assyrians here. Then they moved them up this direction, they were backing up to Asher. They had a battle there, knocked them out there, went up to Haran. Now the word Haran here, was the word for that is crossroads. But there are crossroads between here and then down into Egypt here, in this Fertile Crescent here. This was a crossroads. Well, they defeated them there. And then over here, they came to Carchemish. About this time, over here, we had another little map off here, is Egypt. King Pharaoh Necho of Egypt comes up here, and he marches down this king's highway here, all the way up here to go to meet the Babylonians with the army of Egypt, as well as the armies of the Assyrians, to battle this threat that we see right here. Now, if you get an idea of ISIS here, I hope that you would, because these guys are just moving rapidly up and through here. You're sitting down here watching this, and as you look at that, you look up north, these are not very far away from you. So I want you to get the feel of that. They're on the move.
Here's a picture of ruins of Carchemish, some idea of what that looks like today. But anyway, it was a major city and many major battles were fought there. The Egyptian king Pharaoh Necho II was delayed at Megiddo by the forces of King Josiah and Judah. Josiah was killed and his army was defeated. The dead body of Josiah was delivered to Jerusalem immediately and buried according to the custom of Judah's kings near the grave of King David. In 2 Kings 23:24 through 27, moreover, Josiah removed the mediums and the spiritists and the teraphim. Now, the teraphim were small household idols, human-formed idols that they would carry with them. In fact, Jacob and his family was going away from Laban, Rachel took some of those teraphim, or the household gods, and hid them in her saddlebags or sitting on them. And of course she said she was having her period at the time, so they didn't go and check to where those gods were going. But these were kind of like good luck charms to those people. When they came to Bethel or the house of God, they had to remove them because God did not want to have idols in that area and in this place that would be called the house of God. All right. And the idols and all the abominations that were seen in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem, that he might conform to the words of the law which is written in the book that Hilkiah the priest found in the house of the Lord. Before him there was no king like him, and he turned to the Lord with all his heart, with all his soul, and with all his might, according to all the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him. He was a great king, is what he said. However, the Lord did not turn away from the fierceness of his great wrath in which he angered against Judah because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. This is his dad. Manasseh was a terrible king. He actually went after every god you could think of. If there was a new god in town, he was the one that would first embrace it. The god of Moloch was a terrible god too. This god had a hole in his belly and his arms outstretched. And they would put the children in the arms of this god, and his belly was fire. They would actually roll these children into the fire and burn them. You said, how could they get that far off? Well, they got so far off by going after all these gods, and they would say, well, we didn't receive a good crop this year, and we need to have a sacrifice to Moloch because Moloch is our god. And so maybe one family would have to draw a lot, pick a family member, and that family member would have to give up their child to this fiery god of Moloch. And of course, as we go on further with that, we'd find that the areas that this Gehenna area, or the Valley of Hinnom, which was a beautiful, beautiful grove at one time, became a slaughterhouse and became nothing more after that than a garbage dump because they had to keep the fires burning to keep the stench out of Jerusalem. And that's where we get our word hell from, Gehenna. So he said, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to remove Judah from my sight as I removed Israel. And I'll cast off Jerusalem, this city which I've chosen, and the temple of which I said, my name shall be there. Wow. So here you are in Jerusalem, and here's this prophetic word being said to you. 2 Chronicles after this says, after this, when Josiah set the temple in order, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to make war at Carchemish on the Euphrates. And Josiah went out to engage him. I want to point out something to you. The Bible is a book of antiquity. The Bible is a book that actually has history in it, real history. It's not just made up stuff. It is real history. So here he is, this Necho, but Necho sent messengers to him, to Josiah, saying, what do we have to do with each other, O king of Judah? I'm not coming against you today, but against the house of which I was at war. And the God has ordered me to hurry. Stop for your own sake for interfering with me, who is with me, so that he will not destroy you. However, Josiah would not turn away from him, but disguised himself in order to make war with him. Nor did he listen to the words of Necho from the mouth of God, but came to war on the plain of Megiddo. However, the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of wrath which he had angered against Judah, because, that's the wrong state. Let's go here. The archers then shot King Josiah, and the king said to his servants, take me away, for I am badly wounded. So his servants took him out of the chariot, carried him on the second chariot which he had, and brought him to Jerusalem, where he died and was buried in the tombs of his fathers. All Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. Then Jeremiah chanted a lament for Josiah, and all the male and female singers speak about Josiah in their lamentations to this day. And they made them an ordinance in Israel. Behold, they are also written in the Lamentations. The going on further in the history, it says, the Egyptians, the Assyrians together, crossed the Euphrates and laid siege to Haran, which they failed to retake. They then retreated to northern Syria. Going down with the battles, the Egyptians met the full might of the Babylonian army led by Nebuchadnezzar II at Carchemish, where they combined Egyptian and Assyrian forces, were soundly destroyed. Assyria ceased to exist as an independent power, and Egypt retreated, and was no longer a significant force in the ancient Near East. Babylonia reached its peak at 605 B.C. In the Nebuchadnezzar Chronicle, now housed in the British Museum, claims that Nebuchadnezzar crossed the river to go against the Egyptian army, which lay at Carchemish. They fought with each other, and the Egyptian army withdrew before them. He accomplished their defeat and beat them to non-existence. As for the rest of the Egyptian army, which had escaped from defeat so quickly that no weapon had reached them, in the district of Hamath, the Babylonian troops overtook and defeated them, so that not a single man escaped to his own country. At that time, Nebuchadnezzar conquered the whole area of Hamath. Battle is also mentioned and described in the Bible in the book of Jeremiah and 2 Chronicles. So, this is what happened. Babylonia comes up on a march. Comes up here to Carchemish. Fights the battle there with Pharaoh coming through here on the king's highway. Now, the reason Josiah was going to go against this guy is because he's working in his territory against them. Israel is kind of sandwiched between all of these countries coming up from here down, and also Egypt. So they were kind of in the crosshairs of both these countries. And then Megiddo is where he was killed, and then had to go back to Judah, or to Jerusalem, to be buried. This is the thing that's happening here at this time, 605. So Habakkuk starts out, the oracle or the burden which Habakkuk the prophet saw. How long, O Lord, will I call for help, and you will not hear? I cry to you violence, yet you do not save. Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Therefore the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore justice comes out perverted. Doesn't sound too much like the United States, does it? Huh? When you go to a court of law, do you feel that you're necessarily going to get justice? Or do you just look at it as almost like a crapshoot, maybe you cross your fingers, hope that it goes for the best? I have never seen such stuff as I've seen today. And some of the things I've even witnessed personally. I know a man that actually took a church building, sold it wasn't his own, sold it, and got by with it. I don't know how he did that. I would love to find out. In my day and time, they'd have thrown the man in jail for the fraud that he did. You know, but maybe he made a deal and said, I'll pay him back or whatever. I don't know. They wouldn't have done that in my day and time when I was younger. Not at all. And then you look at the things that you're seeing today and you're impressed. How many times do you see crooked and profane receive lighter or no prison time for offenses that used to put criminals away for long periods of time? If anybody's ever looked at Fox News at times, you've seen this judge in Vermont. The man that actually had violated several children, and yet all of a sudden he gets a slap on a wrist and maybe a little probation. That man would have been in jail for the rest of his life during this time, way back in when I was a child or growing up. Some blacks are crying out for justice, while some of them ask for policemen to be killed and also burn down neighborhoods and loot black businesses. Ferguson is a great example of this foolishness. The point is, and of course, well, this would never have happened if the guy hadn't shot so-and-so. The police officer was doing his job, according to the reports. And yet we have this kind of justice being going on. Claims of police brutality. Now, there's been times police have been brutal. I'm not suggesting that's not true. But I want you to look at what's being said here. Fathers failing to pay child support but still have privileges of seeing their children. I had an uncle that did that. He failed to pay his child support. They threw him in a state penitentiary in Salem, Oregon, when that happened back in the 60s or so. I'm just trying to point out to you there's been things that have greatly changed. Now, this is what was happening in some of these things were probably happening in the time of Judah, and he's looking at the crooks getting by with stuff, paying off judges, those kind of things. God gives him his response. Look among the nations, he says. Observe, be astonished, wonder, because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans is another name for the Babylonians. Babylonia and Chaldea are the same. That fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to see dwelling places which are not theirs. They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves. If you were sitting back there in about 605 and you heard word of what happened at Carchemish and how the Egyptians were knocked out, and let's go back, I just want to do a quick back look at this thing.
We mentioned that in Hamath right here, this area right here. This is where the Egyptians were coming through that had not reached Carchemish, and they just came down and completely wiped them out. Well, that's not very far from your town and where you're at. How do you feel about this?
Well, God says, you know what, Habakkuk, you're bringing this burden to me, but I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. These people I just told you about, these Chaldeans or these Babylonians, they're dreaded and feared. They actually knocked out two world powers. They are dreaded, and their justice and authority originate with themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards. I want you to get the beautiful imagery of what he's saying here. When you see a horse was probably the most feared weapon of war that they had back then. It'd be like our armored tanks today. That the horse could, you can just imagine a big steed marching through this building here, or just marching you out of the parking lot, and he's galloping at you. They just knock you flat. And some of them might even have spikes on them or whatever, just to completely destroy you. But their horses are swifter than leopards. Some of these cats can go somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 miles an hour, and yet here, these horses like that. And these people are keener than wolves in the evening. An evening wolf is a wolf of prey. He's out to destroy these people, and they're the prey. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. Then he says, they fly like an eagle swooping down to devour. Imagine in your mind that an eagle is spread out way up in the sky, and their vision is just really, really keen. And on that is a little tiny field mouse just scooting across the field there, and this great big eagle's there, and just turns himself down and a whoosh like that, nails that field mouse just like that. That's how these people are. This is the kind of power they have. All of them come for violence. They love to fight. They love to kill. They love to, they just love what they're doing. And there's some individuals in the military that, some, not all of them, but I see some of the military there, especially those, they got into some of these, the forces that they were in. I'm not saying everybody's in, say, the infantry is like that, but there have been a few just like that who just love to fight. Not because they're fighting for what's right or whatever, they just love a war. Give me a battle fighter, give me a boxing match, just give me something. Their horde of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. So here they are just grabbing, like the child going on the seashore playing with sand, and the sand going through their fingers. They're just playing with these people. Wow. Something like ISIS, just walking through, chopping off heads, and doing all kinds of crazy things, burning people alive. And now these people may not have been as quite as wicked as that, but still, they're on the move. In other words, this is not the JV team. Babylonia and Chaldea is not like a JV team, like it's called about ISIS.
I want you to understand, this is a force that's there.
They mock at kings, and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at fortresses and heap up rubble to capture it. They will sweep through the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty. They whose strength is their God. The Egyptians, coupled with the Assyrians, were destroyed by the Babylonians or the Chaldeans. Strong, powerful group of people. The imagery that Habakkuk is giving is profound. But Habakkuk has a response. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge, and you, O Rock, have established them to correct. Your eyes are too pure to prove evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look on favor with favor on those who deal treacherously? That would be a good question, right? I mean, we're not quite as bad as this particular group of folks that are coming against us. Certainly we don't have that haughtiness and proud. We do have some haughtiness and proud because we're not pride because we're not following your will, but we're not quite as bad as these folks. That's his point. Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things under without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. You've all seen people throwing out a dragnet type of thing for fish, haven't you? And the fish go into that, and then they just pull up the cords, and up comes a whole pile of fish all just in one big bundle there. He's saying, now this is what's happening. These Chaldeans just go with their hook and their drag, and they get their net out there, and they just gather up nations. Therefore, they're glad and rejoice. Therefore, they offer a sacrifice to the net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large, and their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? In other words, God, you've unleashed a monster here. Now, chapter 2 and verse 1, I think, is in the wrong spot, so we'll just read it as if it were verse 17 of chapter 1. He says, I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. In other words, I'm talking to the God of heaven here, and obviously he's smarter and wiser than I am, but I need to get some understanding here. Why would he have somebody that wicked come against us? The Lord asked and said to me, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. Now there's been a question of the translation on that, whether it means the one who reads it may run or whether the guy's running can see a sign big enough as he's running. Probably more inclined to what this translation is saying here. He says, for the vision is yet for appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it, for it will certainly come. It will not delay. Wow. Now, it's going to happen. Now, what's the next question in your mind? How are righteous people going to live, isn't it? Isn't that your first question? Should be. How are we going to live? Here comes this Babylonian force that just knocks down everything, looks at a fortress. You build a big city with walls around it. No big deal. We'll just build a rampart up there. We'll put a bunch of dirt up there, and we'll just climb over that thing and capture you. Just build something we can't destroy. We're real tough guys. We can do this kind of thing. So how are righteous people going to live in a situation like that? He says, behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. Oh, wow. Have you heard that before? Have you heard that in Romans 1:16-17? For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For therein, in the righteousness of God, is revealed the righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Righteous live by faith. That word faith comes from the Hebrew word emunah, and it means or faithfulness. If you actually pick that verse up and read it in the New American Standard Version of the Bible and look at the footnote, it'll have a note there, and it'll say or faithfulness. Okay, what does that mean? Is there a difference between me saying I have faith in my wife and then I'm saying I'm faithful to my wife? You guys see any difference in that? I mean, I can believe my wife all day long, right? Have all the faith in the world to her and have absolutely no faithfulness. Faithfulness involves a relationship. This idea, all you have to have is just faith, is foolishness. The Apostle Paul does not, he's quoting this verse, but the important thing is we need to understand what is meant in that verse so we're not looking at it going, oh, yeah, it's just faith. No, it's not just faith. It's the idea of faithfulness. The gospel of Christ leads us to a system of faith that leads us to faith or faithfulness, being faithful to God. Like I said, you can have a belief that says, James says the demons believe and tremble. But the problem that the demons don't have is they don't have faithfulness. And there's a vast difference sometimes between the idea of just believing something and being faithful to something. He says, this is how the right... Now keep that in mind. The righteous are going to live by faith. And you know what? That is the way every righteous person has ever had to live. This is not New Testament stuff. This is not just Old Testament stuff. This is the whole world, no matter where we come from, stuff. We all have to live by faith or faithfulness. And that's what you have to live by today. So he says, here's calamity coming. What are we going to do? Oh my goodness, the Chaldeans are going to come on us, and here we are sitting down here in Jerusalem. What are we going to do? Well, the guy's a proud one. His soul's not right within, but the righteous are going to live by their faithfulness. Now, furthermore, he says, wine betrays the haughty man, so that he does not stay at home. That's the Babylonian. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, which is the state of the dead. And he is like death, never satisfied. People die all the time, don't they? Has death ever been satisfied? No. Neither will the Babylonian be satisfied. He says here, he will also gathers himself all nations and collects to himself all peoples. Will not all these take up a taunt song against him? Even mockery and insinuations against him and say, woe to him who increases what is not his for how long and makes himself rich with loans? In other words, when you go out and grab these people and take over their land and whatever, and you start loaning them money at high interest or whatever you do, you find yourself being enriched by that. Well, aren't these people sitting back there being conquered? Are they going to just say, well, you know what, that's no big deal? No. They're going to be against that Babylonian. Then he says here further here, will not his creditors rise up suddenly, and those who collect from him awaken? Indeed, you will become plunder for them. Because you have looted many nations, all the remainder of the people will loot you because of human bloodshed and violence done into the land, to the town, and to all its inhabitants. Woe to him who gets evil against his for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the land of hand of calamity. Woe to this guy that has a bunch of nations that are bounced between him and them so that he cannot be captured because he'll have to go through all these nations to get to him at this point. He says, you have devised a shameful thing for your house by cutting off many peoples, so you're sinning against yourself. Surely the stone will cry out of the wall, and the rafter will answer it from the framework. Oh, and this building's beautiful for this example. Imagine, this is a house that the Babylonian built. And a stone's crawling out of the wall over here, and these rafters are starting to answer it. In other words, all of these nations, you built a house of cards, is what you have, Babylonia. And he built this house with all these nations. And the more nations you get like this, the problem is that the stone's going to cry out of the wall. In other words, Israel might be crying over here, and the Syrians up here, and somebody else over there, crying out against you, and they're going to come against you. So Paul, the writer here is saying, the God is saying to these people, through Habakkuk, this is a shameful thing you've done. Because this is what's going to happen. It's going to fall apart. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Is it not indeed the Lord opposed that people toil for fire and nations grow weary for nothing? Does God do that? Does God continually let this happen on and on and on? No. God will never let this happen on and on. He puts an end to it. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. Then he says, woe to you who make your neighbors drunk, to mix in your vomit, even to make them so drunk, or drunk so as to look on their nakedness. You will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. He's not just talking about that shameful behavior, although there are people that do that. He's saying, here is a nation that has looked upon the nakedness of other people, their land. And he says, now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. The cup of the Lord is the Lord's right hand will come around to you. This is what goes around, comes around idea. And utter disgrace will come upon your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you. and the devastation of its beast by which you terrified them because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and all its inhabitants. Eventually, people stand up and will not tolerate this. And the whole nation that you built on the house of having all these other nations, this is what's going to happen. Then he stops and said, what profit is the idol whose maker has carved it? Now, Israel got into idolatry badly. The Assyrians were in idolatry. The whole world was in idolatry. So he says, what's the good of this thing? For its ruler maker trusts in his own handiwork when he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake. To a mute stone, arise. And that's your teacher? Really? A dumb stone? You build this idol. Let's say this book here is an idol. I build it up, and I put a face on it. Does it talk? No. But it's made out of stone or rock, and here I am worshiping it and calling this my teacher. Really? And there's no breath. He said, behold, it's overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath at all inside it. It's not alive. Now, there's a song in your songbook, the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth be silent before him. This is a really interesting thing. Where I come from in Table Rock, a lot of times they'll start the service with that song. I think it's about 55 in the songbook. It's the same songbook. I think it's the same book you have here. The Lord is in his holy temple. The point that he's making here is, but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep quiet or shut up before him. All of these idols, all of this commotion, all the Babylonians doing this stuff, the Chaldeans, and everything's happening. Earth, be quiet. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Get rid of your idols. Get rid of your other stuff and start paying attention to God. That is the point he's making. And that is the point that all the earth needed to hear. And that's the point that Judah in particular needed to hear. This is the reason God put these people there. Now, as he talks about this, he talks about God's deliverance and living by faith. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigonoff, which is a highly emotional poetic form. Lord, I've heard the report about you and I fear. Revive your work, he says. Let me go back here. Revive. Well, I can't get that here. He talks about revive your work as it was before. In other words, when God was working with them. He says, God comes from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. Selah. Stop and think about that. God went from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. He actually marched with the children of Israel as they were going through the wilderness wanderings. His splendor covers the heavens, the earth is full of his praise, his radiance is like the sunlight. And his rays flash from his hand, and this is the hiding of his power. When Israel came up from Egypt to Canaan, the point he is making is God saved Israel in the past, and he can do so in the future. So here they are. They come from Paran, Teman and Paran, and they are marching up through here. God was with them during the time of their captivity, as they came out of their captivity in the wilderness wanderings. Before him goes pestilence, and plagues come after him. The 10 plagues of Egypt. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the 10 plagues, a lot of times we teach those 10 plagues and we say, well, they were pretty much, it was irritating, you know, to them, you know. For example, the frogs. If we had a bunch of frogs here and they were all over these seats and you just now squished about 20 or 50 frogs just by sitting down, and these frogs are bouncing all over the place, you'd say, well, that's kind of inconvenient. And it would be. But the Egyptians had these things as gods. The 10 plagues were God versus the gods. In fact, we are going to be studying on the tabernacle sometime soon here, and I'll be probably teaching that thing. But anyway, these plagues were not just an annoyance. These plagues, the frog god was a frog of fertility, like we might see the rabbit today. You know, as we think of rabbits proliferating, frogs proliferated. And so, let's say this place right here was the house where the frog god was. So all these people are praying to the frog god that lo and behold, God, please, to your frog, you tell to the frog god, please send me this and that and make sure I have a lot of animals that are being born to my flocks and whatever, and may I have more children or whatever, and you have the frog god. But now you sat down on his representatives. See, God has a sense of humor here. He gave them all the frogs they could handle and more. And so as they're sitting on frogs, then they get tired of them, they take a broom and beat these frogs and throw them out and just do whatever they can to knock these frogs out. And then you come to the frog house, frog god house, the house of worship. Are you going to be sitting there wondering, can I pray to the frog god now that I killed all these representatives? No, you can't do that, see? He just is kind of messing with their heads. Well, anyway, this is the point. The 10 plagues of Egypt created all kinds of problems there with every god they had, including Pharaoh, when the son of Pharaoh died. That destroyed Pharaoh as a god. Well, he startled the nations. Yet the perpetual mountains were shattered. The ancient hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cush. This is in Ethiopia under distress. The tents of the curtains of the land of Midian, with Gideon doing his thing. We're trembling. In other words, he's talking about all the events in Israel. Did the Lord rage against the rivers, meaning the Nile, the Red Sea, the Jordan River? The Nile, when he turned it into blood? The Red Sea, when he had the Egyptians going through there and their wheels get stuck in the mud as they had moved the waters back, and then he pulls the waters over them? Was God angry at the waters? or wrathful against the sea that you rode on your horses, on the chariots of salvation? This is a poetic imagery he's talking about. It's just as if God went to war and had his chariots there. Your bow was made bare, the rods of chastisement were sworn. Stop and think about it. Selah. You cleaved the earth with rivers. There's no way God wasn't angry with these waterways. God was using them as instruments of his wrath against his enemies and the enemies of his people. The mountains you saw you in quake, the downpour of water swept by. The deep uttered their voice. It lifted high as hands. Sun and moon stood in their places. There's Joshua standing there, you know, with at a fight, and God just kept the sun and the moon in the sky. He did all that for Israel, is what his point is. They went away at the light of your arrows, at the radiance of your gleaming spear. In indignation you marched through the earth. In anger you trampled the nations. You went forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You struck the head of the house of the evil to lay him open from the thigh to the neck. You pierced you with your own spears, the head of his throngs. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation were like those who devour the oppressed in secret. You trampled on the sea with your horses, on the surge of many waters. God did many some marvelous things in protecting Israel, which were his people. When God's people repent and turn, God will be on their side. This happened in the past, and it will happen in the future, and it did happen in their future from that time. But now stop and think about this. If God can do all of that for his people, what happens if his people become his enemy? I don't need to say much more. That's fearful, isn't it? If he could hold the sun and moon in the sky, and he could do all these other things, and give these 10 plagues and knock out that, what would happen if it turns out that he's against them? He says, I heard and my inner parts trembled. At the sound of my lips quivered. Decay entered my bones, and in my place I trembled, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. Imagine yourself sitting there in Jerusalem, just waiting for the Babylonians to come down and take care of it. Because Egypt you can't depend on anymore, it's gone. Assyria is gone, and all those nations that are in between that come down, Egypt's coming on a march, the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. I have to wait. Is that a pleasant thing? You know, when you've done the right thing, and you've been right all along, and you've just done everything you could do to work with God and do the right things, and your nation turns out to become godless, and your schools are taught that there's no God, and atheism and evolution and all this other nonsense are being taught, and God's out of their minds, and you wonder what happened, why it happened this way, while I was in school. I never had people guarding my school when I was going to school. I didn't have to have a police force there. We didn't shoot each other. Did we have bullies there? Yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of bullies there that were bigger than I was and made comments and took care of them. Sometimes somebody was able to take care of them in the back schoolyard or whatever. But be it as it may, we had those things. But nobody said, you know what, I think I should just carry a gun to school and shoot somebody that's just like this. That never happened. Why? You take God out of your life, all you have to do is read Romans chapter 1, 18 through 32. It's a recipe for disaster. Children become disobedient to parents. All this other stuff is that goes along. Homosexuality is looked at as another lifestyle. Court systems go down. whoever's got the power is there. That's what happens here. So he has, here you are, trying to live a godly, righteous life, and God's going to punish these nations, but how are you going to live? You're going to live by your faith or faithfulness. That's how you're going to do it. That's how the Christians did it in the first century, the Roman government against them. That's how anybody in Christianity has ever lived, or even these people back here. Well, what does it mean that way? He says, I gotta wait for these people in Vegas. Then it comes up what it really means to live by faith. For though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fruit field produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exalt in the Lord, or Jehovah, I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like deer's or hind's feet, and makes me to walk in my high places. And then he gives us off to a place where they could sing about this. Look at this. Though he has nothing, he realizes that his faith or confidence has to be in God. He has no other choice. All right, now that we've looked at that, through the trials and tribulation of this life, how are you living? Are you living by your faithfulness to God, even during times when you don't know where your next meal is coming from? Do you see that God has a bigger scheme of things than you do? Can you go through trials and tribulation in this life to give you a strengthened or proven character? That's a really important point. Because Paul says he's not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. For it's the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein, he says, in the gospel, is revealed the righteousness of God from faith unto faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. Can you go through trials and tribulations? Of course, have you obeyed the gospel and put your confidence in God that he can save, can and will save you? Well, these are some of the things that Habakkuk taught and us and is teaching us really today. But the question I look at is, how are we looking at each other when it comes to wanting to know more about God? Here's a God that sent his son to die on a cross for your sins. The question I have to ask anyone is this. If he could do all of that for you, he can do anything else you need to have done. You don't have to live in the richest house. You don't have to live in luxury and all that, because God doesn't always give luxury. But the fact is, as you look at this, you're going to live by faith, or faithfulness to him. Faithfulness includes a lot of things. It's not just the idea I believe in something, because a lot of people believe. But what about me just going to classes and learning stuff? He has some great teachers here. What would prevent me from coming to a Bible class? Unless, of course, I'm hindered by a job or some other issues. But even with that, I might want to consider what I'm doing with a job. But if I can come and I can learn more and put myself to it, I would be much better off. Because you know why? I need to be faithful. Faithfulness is much more than just having faith. The just shall live by faith is much more than that. It's the idea that I want to know all about Jesus and all about God and all I can learn to live this life so that I can be the best I can be, because Jesus gave the best sacrifice that could ever happen. He gave himself. And that is where we are. We need to come to the point where we can give ourselves. And giving ourselves means sometimes just preparing ourselves to do what we need to do. And if there's somebody here that needs to respond to the gospel of Christ, either by becoming a Christian or by just coming forward to deal with public sins, won't you come as we stand and sing?